There we go. We're recording the podcast.
There we go.
Delightful.
Should I do it again? There we go.
Excellent. And he's got props.
Practical sound effects. I don't know. I can't make the sad trumpet noise work. So I've got my sweet
rapper.
So you've
resorted to Foley.
Yeah. I have actually, yeah.
If any of us seem like we're riding a horse all of a sudden halfway through the episode, you know
what I mean? He's a little coconut. Yeah.
What's that? There's somebody at the door. Hello and welcome back to the Skinny Skinny. Yes. Oh, a bit of energy. We were having a good old laugh about the lyrics to Alanis Morissette's Ironic on the way over here, so...
Were you guys walking through the 90s?
We took a wrong turn, that's why we were late. Yes, we're back at EHFM. It's Peter, Ellie, Jamie and Anna here. Hello, everybody.
Hello. Hello.
So we have another fun one today. Maybe not as fun as the Studio Ghibli one, because there's lots of death in this one. But, you know, death can be fun in its own way.
Spoiler.
We're going to be talking about Disco Boy, the new Franz Joukowsky film. We're going to be talking about the new Ryosuke Hamaguchi film, Evil Does Not Exist. And we are also going to be talking about the works of Lynn Ramsey, the acclaimed and kind of depressing but also very good Scottish film director whose debut film Ratcatcher is 25 years old this month. So there's like a season of Lynn Ramsey films on in various places and a restoration of Ratcatcher coming out in cinemas. That's basically just everything that's in the podcast.
Nice.
Like quickly precede. So should we just go straight into the first one, or has anyone got anything else that they want to talk about before we start?
No.
Are we going to do a what have you been watching? Not really.
Well, that's what I'm getting at. Jamie, what have you been watching?
Well, it's been a while. I've been watching loads because actually we haven't actually done a proper podcast for absolutely ages, have we? Since before.
Films? Otherwise, Jamie,
we spent an hour and a quarter.
That's what I'm saying.
Slagging off one of the Studio Ghibli directors.
That's what I'm saying.
That's a proper podcast.
That's what I'm saying. So what I've been watching since the last podcast where we all together is loads.
Okay.
Oh, I think you said you haven't been watching loads.
No, no.
Sorry, I take it back.
Okay.
I fucked it.
I think the best thing I saw.
It's all right, Annie. Make some sound effects to distract them. Is that train coming?
What I was going to say is the best thing I saw, which I'm really sad we didn't get to talk about on the podcast, was Koreeda's new film, mm-hmm. Monster, which totally blew me away, actually. It was kind of like, I don't know why it kind of flew under the radar. I guess it didn't get nominated for any like, the Academy Award, I think, when Wenda's film was preferred. But this was so much better. This is an incredible movie. It's a movie where you don't know at all what's happening until the last third. You think it's one type of movie, then the perspective switches, and then you think it's a totally different type of movie, and the movies that they had in my head were shit, to be honest. Like, I think, oh, this is a film about a bad kid, or this is a film about a bad teacher. Actually, it's a really humanistic, beautiful movie that just took me by surprise. It was really sweet, really really sad, but just beautifully put together. Yeah, really haunting, and just, yeah. Koreeda is one of my favourites. He's really good. And I think his last couple of films have been underrated. Like, I think Broker as well kind of flew
Broker
under the radar.
Broker was lovely.
Yes, I don't know what he's doing that isn't sort of catching fire anymore, like since Shoplifters, is that what it's called? The one that won the Cannes. That's the last time I think one of his films really took off. But yeah, this I think is just as good as up with everybody's absolute best.
Does Monster have any of Koreeda's trademark child traffickers with hearts of gold in it?
No, but it has other people dealing with children with hearts of gold.
Oh,
that you think that maybe they're bad and then it turns out that they're just, wait for it, just human beings with complicated lives.
Oh no.
Yeah, I know.
That makes me feel conflicted about how to feel about these characters. creates an internal tension within myself and also within the story of the film.
You see how it is.
I see how, yeah. Films, they really can do everything. So Monsters, it's still on in cinemas.
It may be actually, yeah.
I think so.
It's probably the best thing I've seen all year, not counting the things I'd seen like previously and we've talked about in the pod, but yeah, it's like fantastic.
Excellent. Well, check it out if you've got the time. That sounded more aggressive. Check it out if you've got the time.
Make the time for it. It was really good. That's
okay.
What I'm saying.
Make the time to watch Monster.
He got more aggressive.
And I had to try and match him, but I couldn't quite get there. Ellie, have you been watching anything interesting?
Well, I was under the weather over the weekend, so I just wanted to watch some like shit, you know, like. Nothing particularly interesting.
It was the Easter weekend.
It was the Easter weekend as well. So I think Peter has a look on his face. We're going to get to what you've been watching over the weekend, which is also shit.
Oh, no, we're going to get to something else that I watched before
that,
but it is a fucking banger.
The only thing that really stood out to me was that I watched the entirety of the new Mr. and Mrs. Smith series on Amazon Prime.
Is it sexy?
Not really.
Oh, well, like, that's the point.
The thing is, it's been so long since I've seen the original. I assume the original hasn't aged well just because it's like, just because I assume it's that very like eye-rolling heteronormativity of like, haha, they're trying to kill each other because they're spies, but also because they're husband and wife.
I will say, you know that one fight scene where they discover they're both spies and they have sex at the end? I used to watch that like porn.
I mean,
when I was like 30.
I think that
too
also,
much information, come on.
I think something that really strips away.
Oh, for the sad trumpet.
I think you say that.
It doesn't work. That's what I'm saying.
But I think something that really strips away the sexiness, because it's Donald Glover and Maya Erskine, right? Which you would hope would be a little bit smoother and like more.
Was that the one you wanted?
But yeah, so
sorry, Ellie. Carry on.
It's really dull. It's not that interesting at all. I think that the big problem is that there is still like a lot of gender essentialism at its heart, even though they're meant to be quite like a more modern married couple than it was in, I don't know, 2007 or whatever. But I think my biggest problem is it's not a good spy film. It's like, I think it's also because it's like Amazon MGM Studios, who are now also the ones doing James Bond, and you get the sense that they're a little bit like rudderless when it comes to the spy genre. So each episode of the series is this like, it's them cutting away to the mission that they're on, but we don't get any details about the mission. The mission itself doesn't actually have any like long bearing on the plot. None of the threads actually come together until the very last episode. And as such, the mission can just be any ridiculous, very specific thing that they have to do that brings out this bickering couple analogy. Like, one episode is that they have to like kidnap and relocate like a high value target or whatever, who turns out to be Ron Perlman and is great in the role, and get it, because they have to put him in the car and drive him around, and he's like, I don't want to be in the car, I want to be somewhere else. And they're like arguing over what to do and whether or not we should take another break or ask for directions, like, haha, because it's like they've got a kid. But the, like, that's not interesting or cool or fun to watch for an hour, is Donald Glover and Maya Erskine bickering over childcare. So that was pretty dull, but I'm not sick anymore, and I don't have to watch it.
I'm not sick anymore, and Mr. and Mrs. Smith brackets 2024 cured me. Anahi, have you watched anything with magical healing properties recently?
I also watched Monster. I thought it was fucking great. Love Monster. Really, really good. The score is like, I've been listening to it a lot. Like, really, really beautiful. I also watched the first film that I have watched in a really long time, like maybe since After Sun, that I was like, oh my God, this is one of the best things I've ever seen in my life, which was Steven Soderbergh's Sex, Lies, and Videotape, which is so good and so sexy. Where did James Spader go? Where has he gone? He was in that one Marvel film as a robot.
He was in Parks and Rec.
He wasn't. He was in the office. Yeah, as the guy. Yeah. But like his run of films in like the 80s, 90s, where he just plays like weird little freaks that are really sexy. Like, we need to bring that back. I don't know who would be the equivalent these days, but we need to find the equivalent.
Barry Keoghan.
Yeah, that's true. But then he's like a little bit more hostile.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, there's a bit of a threat, whereas James Spader was just like, why is this guy so hot? Like, he's doing something, but I don't know what it is.
Yeah, because James Spader, like, because Barry Keoghan is like, he's a bit feral and weird, but he's also quite conventionally attractive.
Whereas
James Spader, I don't wish to, I mean, as a heterosexual man, I don't wish to cast aspersions on James Spader, like, or
he's
anyone
pretty,
else. But,
but like, not,
he's
like,
no Barry Keoghan.
No, he's not. No, that's true. Yeah. But like that little floppy 80s hat. Anyway, great film. Great film.
Good stuff. I watched Irish Wish, the Lindsay Lohan comedy, and I tell you what, I'm not being funny. This is maybe one of the worst films that's ever been made.
Really?
It's so bad. It's so bad on so many that, like, technically, poor. Uh-huh. Filmmaking, not great. Plot, ridiculous. All the Netflix films have to have, the main character has to be a professional woman who is, like, one step removed from the actual interesting thing in their life. So Lindsay Lohan's character is, and like an assistant, she's like the ghostwriter editor for a bad romance writer. And that's, she's like, oh yeah, here's your lead character. You know this person. Imagine the person next to that person. That person is Lindsay Lohan. They go to Ireland for a wedding. There is a, what I would say, someone that they put in the film to be like, we can't have an actual leprechaun. Let's see how close we can get.
Oh, no.
She falls in love with an Englishman in Ireland. Classic. Yeah, there's been a whole bunch of very good stuff written about it, including one piece that was like, did Irish Wish take place in an alternate timeline where Ireland never got independence from the UK? So I would say it's probably too bad to watch as a joke, but give it a punt, see what you think. It's no monster. It's no Mr. It's no Mr. and Mrs. Smith brackets 2024. So that's what we've been watching. Shall we get onto the first of our reviews for this week? Should we do Disco Boy first?
Yeah.
Because it's first on the list. So it means I don't have to scroll as far down my laptop, which is precariously perched on the edge of my leg and the table. No, I'm going to... I feel like the danger is giving me extra energy for this recording of the podcast.
Okay.
Let's see if I say that in 20 minutes time when it's on the ground. Okay, so Disco Boy. After a fraught journey from his home in Belarus, Alexei joins the French Foreign Legion in the hope of making a new life en française. Meanwhile, Jomo is the leader of a resistance group in the Niger Delta, battling against the destruction of their homes by Western oil companies. Alexei and Jomo's lives become entwined, as the saying goes, slowly... and then all at once. Franz Rzeszowski plays Alexei, Mora Indai plays Jomo, Letitia Kay plays Jomo's sister Adoka, and Leon Lucev plays the French Legion drill sergeant Paul. The only reason he is in this pre-description, he's in it for about 10 minutes, is that he also plays Lightning McQueen in the Croatian dub of the cast film. The things you find out when you're doing research for this podcast.
Good
and,
for him.
And I was worried because this...
Ka-chow.
Life is a highway. Now, what's that in Croatian? But I had to go through so many different places to find this out because it was all just on various wikis. And ever since like ChatGPT's become a big thing, I'm just always concerned that information is basically null and void in this day and age. So, but no, I have confirmed
that he was
Leon Lucev, Lightning McQueen.
Okay.
Life is a highway confirmed. Let's roll. Yeah, this is a debut feature by Italian director Giacomo Abruzzese. And yeah, it's Franz Rogowski in the lead, and it's quite an interesting, but Jamie, quite an odd film.
Yeah, it's a very vibey film, I would say. It's like a film that really works. It's a film that just kind of runs on dream logic a lot of the time, but I find it really gorgeous. It does have a narrative, but the filmmaker does seem more interested in these kind of poetic digressions that it goes down. So the narrative has got kind of two strands. The main one follows Franz Rzeszowski as this kind of illegal immigrant. Well, one thing that struck me is, like, I didn't know much about the Foreign Legion. Like, all my knowledge of it was from, like, Tintin comics and, like, that one Jean-Claude Van Damme film. I've used any pair, I'm sure you have. Where you joined
I was going to say, is Beau Travail not one of your favourite films?
Beau Travail, but it's actually, it doesn't go into any details about you wouldn't know what, I mean, could it be any kind of, they're just like soldiers abroad. You know? But I didn't know that the kind of main kind of tenet of it was like, there's like this kind of bargain you make when you join that in 5 years, you know, once you've shed blood for France, you are a French citizen. Which is a kind of disgusting idea when you think about it. And that's obviously why all these desperate people get drawn into that organization. So that's what happens to Franz Rzeszowski's character, Alex. And then the second strand, you've got this character, Jomo, who is introduced in, I think, one of the best intros of any film where, you know, he's part of this kind of resistance movement called MEND, which is the Movement for the Emancipation of Niger Delta. And he's introduced by a vice journalist just turning up out of the blue on a motorboat to interview him and his gang of terrorists. It's hilarious. It's like, it's very funny. It's a film that actually does have a sense of humor, even though it's kind of very art house. But yeah, what happens is these two guys get intertwined. I don't want to say how they get intertwined, but they get intertwined in a really interesting poetic way, and the scene actually where they meet is fantastic, where it's like shot in kind of like night vision.
I would say this is comfortably second place on creepiest, most intense night vision scenes of the calendar year 2024.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not going to get number one, but it's pretty safe in the second spot.
Along with the Zone of Interest.
Yes,
but this is more like
that's heat vision. Your one is heat vision, I think. Zone of Interest is night vision, right? Yeah. Is that the difference? Like, it was thermal,
maybe,
like with the red.
Yeah, two totally different effects.
Like fucking Harmony Korine's, what was it called? Agro Drift.
I didn't see that. It's more like the Predator as well. Like, but anyway. They're kind of consciousness get intertwined in some way. I think it's like, is that kind of film where it's like very hallucinogenic, very dreamy. it then becomes like, it's very temporal as well. You don't know where, like, it's sort of the geography doesn't really exist in this movie, because they'll travel from Africa to Paris nightclubs in one kind of transition. So it's a film that you have to just go with the vibe. I found it very hypnotizing. Like, I thought Franz Rosowski is great. Like, he's just like great to watch. He's great to move. The way he moves is really interesting. So yeah, it's a film that didn't sort of satisfy me, I think, in the end. I think that it does have problems. I think the relationship between the two characters is a bit imbalanced. I think for a film that's sort of making sort of comments on the West and something imperialism and things like that, I think it's a mistake to make your black character so secondary and sort of so kind of a cipherish, and sort of gives them so little backstory. So I think that was, for me, the major flaw in the film, that it's so weighted towards Alex's experience and his kind of trauma. But otherwise, I thought it was a kind of fantastic debut, like really gorgeous, full of amazing imagery. The soundtrack is fantastic. It's this kind of like a pulsing electronic soundtrack. So yeah, like, this is a film that was like a joy to watch, I think.
Yeah, I agree. I think that this is a film with some real fuzzy edges, and I think that works sometimes to its benefit, and sometimes it can make it maybe a bit more difficult for people to watch. I think that there's like a really morally complex question in the very center of it. It shows Alexei and Jomo kind of with equal amounts of sympathy, but on top of that, the film is very absent of anyone who's actually like pushing the conflict that we're seeing going on here. Like, they're both sort of unwitting participants. You get the sense they're sort of backed into a corner, they don't have a lot of other options, but you don't necessarily see any characters who are pushing this agenda that these characters have to be at odds with one another. Even the commanding officer, whose actor's name I've immediately forgotten, but I'm just now just gonna call Lightning McQueen, even seems to sort of like respect and affirm that these people are only here for a passport. Like, in a weird way, like, he seems to know what they're doing is quite debasing and traumatic, but at the same time, he's kind of just trying to like get them through it, kind of uplifting them, which is very strange for a character. I mean, it gets endearing at a point, really, when they're doing like military cadence, but instead of singing "I don't know what I've been told," they're doing like an old love song.
Oh, it's like it's
stereotype, isn't it? That every French film has "Je ne regrette rien" in it. Absolutely every French film. But the sense of setting of the world is very, like you say, we're sort of just flitting between nightclubs and different locations and stuff like that. Like, you know, they're kind of undefined, and I think that helps drive home this film's principal setting is just the Western military industrial complex and how it is at home and abroad, and how it can take people from completely different places in the world, and they can be equally voiceless, but they're sort of pitted against each other. And yeah, I think that it's a really, really like touching film in a weird way, to sort of see these characters wrestle with the fact that they kind of have no other place in the world in a weird way. But you know, I think it's very beautiful. I think it's very dreamy. I think it's very, it has that ambiguity. It kind of keeps audiences at a bit of a distance. And I think that I liked that. But I do agree that I think that some people will probably walk away with it feeling a bit weird.
Mm. Yeah.
I mean, we've already covered this, but I think it's absolutely fucking bananas that France will hand out citizenship if you're willing to kill for the state. Mm-hmm. I think that is insane. And I think what I like, I agree with you that it's mostly Franz Rogowski's character's film. And I think that that can be kind of problematic. But I think especially, I don't want to like spoil the end, but especially like the end and even that end shot of like kind of the way that it's framed, I think it's really just a critique of that system almost, right? And obviously embroiled in that is all this stuff about like the violence of borders, about like French colonialism, but it really is a take on like, how is this kind of like neo-colonialism continuing to be perpetrated? How are really vulnerable people like made complicit in the violence of the state? And I think that's really interesting. I saw this at GFF, and the way that like the program notes or whatever were written, it kind of sounded like it would be something about toxic masculinity. And so kind of the first half hour was like, I don't think it's doing a very good job of that. But actually, I think it's about colonialism. Yeah. And when it kind of goes to the Niger Delta.
What is colonialism? If not the most toxic form of masculinity.
No, truly. Yeah. But then it kind of like clicked and started to make sense. And it's like stylistically, like you were saying, really interesting. I think we are maybe hitting a bit of a moratorium. How do you say that word? Moratorium? Yeah. Moratorium? Yeah. Moratorium on people having like an existential crisis in a club. I think maybe we've we've done that quite a bit. But they do those scenes really well. And I agree as well that it doesn't necessarily, there's a kind of sense when it goes back from the Niger Delta back to France, that the film is kind of fizzling out, but that kind of also felt a bit like the point, right?
Yeah.
That sort of violence does just fizzle out, that you're waiting for this big moment of either catharsis or this big moment of release or a crescendo, or for it to, the violence to culminate, and actually awful things happen, and then people just kind of go about their lives in really horrible ways. And I thought that was actually quite clever. So yeah, I don't think it's like a perfect film. It felt like a little bit, maybe seen before, a little bit unfinished, but really promising. And he's great. Franz Rogowski, king, continues to rule. So good.
Yeah, I think it's one of those films that does feel like, if you, when somebody says afterwards, oh, it was that guy's first film, you're like, ah, that makes sense.
Yeah, for sure.
And when you hear Franz Rogowski talking in interviews and stuff, talking about how this film, this director's been trying to make this film for like 10 years, you also get that sense that like there's a story bundling its way out, but maybe being made by somebody who hasn't worked at this scale before.
Yeah.
And you get into some issues with that. But overall, a very interesting, exciting, and like trying something different a lot of the time, which is really good.
Yeah. It's also really bold, I think, to reference so heavily Beautrevai, which I think is one of the best films ever made, and like almost steal its ending. But like, I think the films do work quite well together. I think actually, for someone who's like nicking ideas from Claire Denis, I think Claire Denis would like this film. It's got the same sort of sensibility as her, you know, like, and that it just trusts you to like go along with the poetics of it. Actually, it doesn't really matter if you don't quite know the people's motivations, or it feels, everything feels real, you know, like the emotions feel correct.
There's a few times when reality sort of breaks and you have characters who are speaking English even though they don't really have any reason to be.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think that's really interesting. Not just that they're speaking English, but they're incredibly verbose as well. Like, there's these two members of MEND. I think one of them is Jomo, who's like, they're on the river and they're talking about like what things would be like if they were born on the other side. What things would be like if they were born white, which is where the film gets its name, because one of them says that he'd be a disco boy. But like, yeah, just that sort of like, even though there's clearly this like very demanding, pressing global issue at play, that characters still have the time to sort of just like sit and like share their thoughts and have a little bit of like a little conversation and take you down a sort of strange alleyway in the film's script. And I think that, you know, happens in multiple ways throughout. I think, again, what we were talking about earlier with the thermal vision in one scene is part of that, where it just decides to sort of break up what it has been looking like or sounding like so far, just to take you away from it a little bit and really, you know, exercise the imagination of the viewers.
Yeah, I think it is a film, yeah, like we said, references a bunch of other films. A film that I had just watched a couple of weeks before we watched this, Annihilation, is another one. There's actually some kind of, there's some similarities in a way, but like there's one particular thing where I was like, ah, I see someone else has a Netflix subscription. yeah, so Disco Boy, an adventurous, ambitious film. It's probably, I think, well worth watching. So it's out right now. It's on at GFT and Cameo in the week that this podcast comes out, and it'll probably still be doing the rounds for a couple of weeks after that. So go and check it out. And also go and watch Beautrevai. And the Jean-Claude Van Damme film was called Legionnaire. And Jean-Claude Van Damme plays, wait for it, a boxer who falls in love with a mafia boss's wife.
Oh, no.
And then he has to go and join the Foreign Legion to get away. But he learns things like how to more effectively attack people.
Such as the mafia boss?
Yeah.
Okay.
Spoilers. Spoilers in the preceding quip for the film Legionnaire. Okay, next up, Evil Does Not Exist, which is the new film from Ryosuke Hamaguchi. It is the follow-up to his, I've seen it described by a lot of people, surprise Oscar winner, Drive My Car, a long film I haven't seen. Mm-hmm. So, Takumi and his daughter Hana live a simple rural life in a small village near Tokyo. Plans for a glamping retreat that have been put forward by a Tokyo talent agency come along and shake things up a bit. It is quite an interesting film that there might be some disagreement about its various merits, namely from me. But Anahit, you've written in the notes, this is a masterpiece exclamation mark, so I'll let you go first.
I have. I wonder if this is partly because I didn't really love his two films that everyone does think are masterpieces, which I've seen, which are Drive My Car and We Love Fortune and Fantasy, which I think we talked about on the podcast. And so just like being able to enjoy this film and being able to be like, oh my God, like I feel something happening. I was just so fucking delighted. So I was like, do I have bad taste? But it turns out no, I have impeccable taste because I think this is great. This reminded me a little bit of, it's funny that we were talking about Monster earlier, because it reminded me a little bit of that, just in the way that it's like this very kind of slow film that's to do with like the quotidian moments in people's lives. Like there is no big like drama occurring, but within these like conversations that are maybe a little bit unsaid, or these like brief interactions, or even someone picking someone up from school or driving to a meeting, there's so much that's going on beneath the surface. I haven't seen this in a while, actually. I saw it at Venice, and I remember just this really like almost like infective, like haunted sense throughout the film. Like it's like dealing a lot with ideas of the environment, and the landscape feels hostile in a way that is entirely merited and earned. You get the sense that it's its own force that is kind of standing back against people, which is like really cool. It's like something bigger and more powerful than the characters that move through it. And yeah, it's just very, yeah, a very like weird, little complicated environmental fable in a lot of ways. But I think one of the things I liked most about it was that it has this sort of, which is maybe what reminds me of Corrida a little bit, is it has this really big sense of empathy towards everyone in the film. Like you have these kind of quote unquote good guys and bad guys, the guys that are coming in from like this very funny glamping hub, which unfortunately I would probably go to because I don't believe in tents. But they like come in and they're kind of the bad people, but then he kind of shows how they're actually just like really human. There's this really like sweet little romance that I remember. It is this film that I'm thinking of, right? Mm. That happens in the car.
Yeah.
It's not so much a romance, but they are having just a lovely chat.
Yeah, you know? And it's just like, oh yeah, this is how you kind of fancy someone. Like it just felt really like nice. And yeah, this empathy also goes like to the locals, to the wilderness, to, like the unpredictability of the environment itself. When bad things happen, it's not, the film doesn't take this really judgmental tone with it, which I think is really cool. It builds this crescendo that I think is quite divisive. When I saw it, I was like, oh, that makes me feel weird about the whole film. And I had to think about it for a bit. I know, Jamie, you didn't love it. But there was something about it that felt like quite almost like Greek, like Greek tragedy in a way, like the sense of like big and small scale happening at the same time. And you're just a bit like, wait, what the fuck? And it's just so metaphorical and symbolic. And I like that he went there. Like he didn't have to. He could have ended it in a much more like quieter way, but it's just like a bit fucking weird. Yeah, I really like this. But I think I'm also just so happy to finally like Hamaguchi film. So that's a big part of it.
I have been vindicated. Yeah. This film is great. Yeah. Jimmy, I know that you enjoyed this.
I loved this.
Setting aside your feelings about the ending, which we can come on to shortly.
I loved this apart from the last 3 minutes. But yeah, I it's a film that it opens in such an amazing way that it opens with this kind of amazing tracking shot just looking up at the sky. And it went on for 5 minutes. And it's so funny because like I was watching Bjorn, my husband, he came back in from the kitchen. And he said, did you start this again? He says, no, it's still... And it's like it kind of like it acclimatizes you to the pace because the film is, especially in the first kind of half hour, is so kind of slow moving. We watch a man chop wood for, it feels like forever. He goes and gathers water, and we watch him take every single jug of water from his car. Not just one trip, it's about 4 or 5 trips. It's hilarious. And it's just, it gets you into this guy's rhythm, this guy who he's so in tune with nature, it seems like. He knows everything about the forest. There's lovely scenes of him walking around with his daughter, and they're just talking about the different plants, and they find various dead carcasses. And there's a kind of ominous, you know, even though it's like, it's this weird tension, because it is like very serene. It's this kind of beautiful, quiet landscape, but it is also menacing. There's something going on with the soundtrack. It's this kind of lush, beautiful soundtrack that builds and builds and builds, and then it'll just stop suddenly, and it gives you this kind of really unnerving feeling. And like I say, there's like there's bones in the forest, there's like trees that will cut you if you touch them. Lots of kind of like metaphorical stuff going on. And then it has this I'm realizing that Hamaguchi is really interested with structure, you know, because all his films have a really interesting structure. So like Drive My Car, it had like a 45 minute prologue and then stopped, and then the film began, and then it went on for another 3 hours. So he's interested in that kind of, I guess just not doing the three act structure, you know. So this does have a three act structure, but they're all very different in tone. So it goes from this very quiet opening to a very long like community meeting about septic tanks, and it's very funny and awkward, and it's like a, and it's like
it's the Japanese art house version of that episode of This Is Parks and Rec where Patton Oswalt does the full Star Wars monologue.
Exactly. And then it does something very interesting because it's totally like you say, Annie, it changes the perspective, and the people who we are set up to hate become actually very nice, and you're not actually sure where the film's going to go, and it's constantly defying cliches and sort of expectations, and I loved all that. I thought it was very, it went from this kind of very gentle hypnotic opening to being very funny and like awkward, a kind of comedy of manners almost, and I thought it was going to go somewhere great and somewhere powerful, and to me, not to spoil the ending, I just felt the ending, it's an ending that's just inexplicable to me. I can hear arguments, but for me, the film, the ending just didn't make sense, and it felt like a slap in the face. It's like, it just, I don't know. Maybe it's, again, it's my fault. I just don't get it, or I need to read a bit more or watch it again or something, but it just sort of escaped me, and it kind of soured what I think is a great film, you know? So like, yeah, I'm a bit uneasy about the whole thing, but there's so much love in this. I just think he's such a great filmmaker. He's so patient. He's like, yeah, like I say, he's got a kind of great attitude with structure and where he does things that you don't expect. Yeah.
I mean, I think that, like, I enjoyed this film, but I think that there is something to be said for the fact that, and you said the ending is this kind of like, all of a sudden, all of the large scale and small scale effects of the film all come into force at once. But up until that very point, there is no large scale. Like, the film seems incredibly small scale for almost the entire duration of its runtime. There's lots of, you're right, like, gorgeous cinematography. It feels just very much like a sort of, like, pastoral filmmaking passion project. And the threat, the actual threat that this glamping mob represent is just in the periphery of the film, really. Like you know, we never see deer. We just see their tracks or their bones. The townspeople aren't, like, really puffed up and furious. They're actually just very plainly and quite, like, I don't know, powerlessly just sort of stating what's wrong. I can kind of see why some people would feel that the beginning was really slow because it is so static and quiet. But almost as soon as we get into that town hall meeting, like, that's when it becomes so much more of an enjoyable watch because everyone's just radiating character. You're right. It is very like Parks and Rec, but in a totally different way where it's just like, I don't know, it's kind of like flipped over. We're sort of supporting the other side for once, where you have these talent agency people come in saying, like, these are the plans. This is how it's going to work. Does anybody have any questions? And then someone's just like, it's not going to work. And that's it. Like, there's no, like, it's incredibly awkward. But somehow the characters are still, like, really, like, vibrant and fun to watch. The townspeople do have one token young adult. There's this one guy with, like, bleached hair who wears a jumpsuit and vapes all the time. Love him. Just love that he's there. He's the only person. He's the only, like, adult in this community that's, like, under the age of 50 or something like that. But I think that the real beating heart of this film is the guy who's part of the talent agency itself. Like, he's the representative for this glamping project. And he just immediately falls completely in love with the mountain man protagonist. In our first scene with him alone, he's in the car speaking with his partner and building up some chemistry where he's like, yeah, you know, this job is fine. I've been thinking about doing something different though. And then when they arrive on the mountain and we see the mountain man, he's just like, can I hold your axe? Will you teach me how to chop wood? And like that, in that way, the title is really successful. Like it avoids discussing the ecological impact on this community in a very textual sense. The seriousness, like the morbidity, is only discussed in the very like long silences between the characters. Like how you have these people who have come to this community and they're very enthusiastic about just doing a good job. Like they don't seem to care that much about this particular job they're doing, but like they begin to form some affection for the people around them. And then the more they learn that this is kind of like a really tainted project, they just fall into silence and like sit in quiet, awkward contemplation, much like how in the beginning of the film it's so quiet. And yeah, I mean, I think that then all of a sudden it all comes to this very rupturous end where it really smashes you over the head with the fact that there is an incredibly grave, like, human impact that this kind of like reckless anti-ecological capitalism can cause. And yet there are no villains here, and it's the characters themselves that we've been watching and supporting that wind up turning on each other. And it is ambiguous. It's incredibly cryptic, the ending. And I'm looking forward to seeing it a second time because I want to go in and just reassess that and rethink about where everything's placed in the film leading up to that point. But at the same time, you know, I felt throughout the film, it was fun, beautiful, enjoyable, quite sweet. And it's like, well, it shouldn't be. There's something that's actually very sinister that's going on here that no one's really aggressively pointing out is that sinister. And I think that's what the film is trying to do in this sort of huge, sort of widely symbolic finale.
Yeah. I think it is an interesting film. I think it is very slow and very quiet and very, it's one of those films where people say, oh, it's very deliberate. Go on. It moves at its own pace. And that pace is quite slow. But I appreciate the cinematography is lovely. The performances are all great. It's one of those ones where, and we have these sometimes on the pod, in this pod we do, where it's like all of the technical things in this film are good. Thematically, it's quite interesting. It just didn't grab me on account of the fact it was trying to grab me moving extremely slowly. It's like being chased.
You'd think that'd be more
it's like
successful.
Being chased by a sloth. But yeah, I mean, like, I think what I would say is it is a good film. Your mileage just might vary on how much you enjoy it personally. So the important thing to remember, as we often have to say to Jamie Dunn when he says things like, maybe I just didn't get this because I'm watching it wrong, it's not your fault if you don't like this film.
Does he say films, that?
He said he wasn't sure whether the ending of Evil Does Not Exist was good or not because he might have just not read enough books or like understood it enough.
Yeah, well, I think sometimes you like I can't you don't want to go with so much hubris that the film is wrong. Sometimes you could be wrong as well. I think
that just doesn't sound like you.
And sometimes, Jamie, when it comes to hubris, you just split the difference. You're both wrong. So Evil Does Not Exist is out on Friday.
Yeah. I'd say go. I want to see it in the big screen, actually. So if you can see it in the big screen.
Peter, that slowness that you detected, I immediately detected once I like loaded it up on Vimeo, on the streamer that we were given, on my laptop in the middle of the day and being like, wow, absolutely everything in my living room is more overstimulating than this film right now.
If I wanted to lie down and watch the sky, I could be doing it right now. So Evil Does Not Exist is out on Friday. It's on at the GFT and Cameo from this Friday, and that's on at the DCA from the 12th of April. It's good. As I say, you have been warned, read the slowness. Mm-hmm. But that's just me. Mm-hmm. The one who was talking about Jean-Claude Van Damme about 50 minutes ago. Okay, and for a bit of fun, light-hearted chat to round out the episode, we're going to talk about the collected works of Scottish director Lynn Ramsay. Are you done moving your microphone around down here?
No, I'm just trying to keep spawning.
Are you trying to do more live Foley? Are you trying to sneak back into the room?
I just noticed how cool Annie's mic is, actually.
You got a fancy
What's
one.
Going on there?
I'm very cool. Yeah. You noticed.
You took the bounty.
Yeah, I took the bounty. Yeah, Jamie.
You get the best mic.
Not you, but other Jamie. Yeah.
That doesn't make any sense to the listener.
No.
There were chocolates when we got here. Now you're up to speed. Lynn Ramsay, one of Scotland's most beloved, but arguably bleakest filmmakers. Basically, her debut film, Ratcatcher, is 25 years old this year. So it is getting a 25th anniversary 4K re-release, and it's out in cinemas from the 12th, so next Friday. So we're going to do a quick speed run through the Lynn Ramsay back catalogue. Hold on to your hats, this is going to be a fun one. But Jamie, before we start doing that, as our resident person who knows lots about all the films ever, just give us a brief background on Lynn Ramsay, who she is, etc., before we discuss the films themselves.
Well, I would say she is the greatest Scottish filmmaker, don't you think? Or certainly living filmmaker, I would say she's fantastic. But unfortunately, she's not made that many films. She's a filmmaker who's really been scuppered. She's had like a lot of near misses. But yeah, she started as a photographer, I believe, and that you can tell that from her movies straight away. Like, her films are really about images. Like, there's dialogue doesn't really play much of a part, even though she's like adapted like a lot of books like for her films. Like, she's more interested in like images and editing and working with actors. You know, that's her bread and butter. Yeah, and she's a filmmaker where I feel like her films are very much about the tone, about the kind of texture of the worlds that they exist in. And yeah, I guess they are quite miserable, but there is a kind of quite often a kind of magic to them as well. Like, you know, something, as I'm sure we'll talk about, some of her films kind of like, even though they're kind of social realists, they're not like a Ken Loach film. They do have like moments where they'll kind of burst into like magical moments or moments of like joy and sort of yeah, like magic. So yeah, I can't think of a better word to describe that.
But that's true. Yeah.
Yeah, she's a great filmmaker. But yeah, like sadly, she's not made all the films. She planned like a Moby Dick film in space that got cancelled.
What?
She had, is it Jane Got the Gun she was going to make, but she got kicked off that. That was with Natalie Portman. So she's had all these kind of like films that she hasn't quite made. So she has only 4 films in a kind of 25-year career, which is outrageous. But yeah.
Is that it?
Yeah, but what 4 films? Wow.
And what a handy number of films for us to discuss on this four-parcel podcast. Ellie, Ratcatcher, 1999. She made a couple of shorts before this, and actually there's a really good piece by Emily Roberts in this month's issue of The Skinny Magazine, which talks about Ratcatcher and the two or three short films that she made just before.
She made 3 short films, but Emily focuses in on Gas Man and Small Deaths.
Yeah. So read that in the new issue of the magazine that's out now, but also listen to this from Ellie Robertson talking about Ratcatcher.
So Ratcatcher was her first feature-length film. It's a difficult film to sort of cram into a synopsis because it's so kind of like, you know, it's not particularly structured. It's not got like a very clear plot. It's more of a just sort of ambient coming-of-age film set in Glasgow in the 70s in tenement flats at a time when there is a bin strike going on. And I think that it's important here what sort of separates, you know, Lynn Ramsey's sort of social realism from poverty porn, at least in this instance, is like a generous use of contrast. So there's lots of like, you know, beautiful Victorian architecture in Glasgow, but we also see the bin bags strewn about the street and everybody's got furniture that's really outdated, but quite sleek. And even for all the dirt and litter that you see, the film has like a surprisingly strong color palette. Like Glasgow does seem quite green, you know, dear green place. Hey, hey. But, and you know, James's dad sits about in a wife beater smoking cigarettes, but he's played by Tommy Flanagan, who I think is quite hot. Like, it's you know, I don't think I'm Googling him. Particularly in Ratcatcher, where he's quite young. I don't think it's yeah, I wouldn't say that Lynn Ramsey's, at least in Ratcatcher, is just like completely bleak. Like, there's violence in the film, but it's never really spectacularized. And James's struggle through the film is his desire to sort of be free from it. The beginning of the film shows his accidental involvement in the death of another boy. And, you know, he never really confronts that verbally, but there are these questions throughout all the different threads of the plot that sort of arise throughout it. Like, you know, when will these bin strikes end, or will this family be rehoused to one of the new builds? And, you know, there's another girl that he sort of like becomes friends with, and it's like, will she ever sort of be free from the local young team that have been harassing her? But they're indirect questions, you know, and they never really get like a completely resolute answer. And again, Lynn Ramsey kind of breaks the realism and goes into these little dream sequences. There's a short fantasy sequence about mice living on the moon, and James gets on a bus and finds himself in one of these new towns under construction and sort of lives out this day just exploring it and imagining that. And he sort of like builds this fantasy for himself. It symbolizes the sort of like promised upward social mobility of the 20th century. But then, you know, his friend Margaret, we see where she lives. She lives in a new build. She lives in a, like a 100-story tenement, like high rise. And that's like a much more realistic depiction of what happened to all the overspill of Glasgow. They didn't get moved to these sort of like utopian little villages out in the middle of nowhere. They, in fact, were just moved into kind of like these quite anonymizing, almost hostile areas of like concentration. I like the film's, you know, quite old and quite beloved, so I'm more comfortable discussing the ending. I don't think it's like a spoilery film, you know, but the plot threads that have been established over the film, which are quite episodic in structure, like they never really materialize. The dreams never really come true that we see being built up, you know. James can't retrieve his friend's glasses from the canal. He can't overcome his fear of water that gets established at the beginning of the film. The family, we never really see them get rehoused, and if we do see them get rehoused, there's that sort of magical lens that gives a real sense of ambiguity as to what's really happened. And Glasgow does get cleaned up, but by the military, by force, which is strange and sort of bittersweet. So it's that thing where it's like there's no direct points being drawn to specific social issues, their problems and their solutions, but rather just that like it is very difficult to grow up in these kinds of conditions, in these sort of like in this ambiguous social class, this limbo, this liminal space between living in Glasgow, which is itself a city that, you know, has been decaying through this bin strike, and then possibly getting moved to somewhere else. It's not clear who's getting moved and why they're getting moved. It's just about James's own perspective and his inability to reckon with the fact that he has no clear answers. So incredibly poignant, incredibly touching. And I wouldn't even necessarily say that it's bleak. I would say that it has great elements of sadness, but there are also some really sweet moments where you get to see James just be a human and connect with other people his age. And as far as I'm aware, uses a lot of the ideas that Ramsay introduces in her short films beforehand. Like, as the piece that Emily wrote for The Skinny makes me think that Ratcatcher is kind of like the summation of some of the themes from the short films. But that's the only Lynn Ramsay film I've seen, so I couldn't actually tell you where her career goes after that.
Well, it goes, it stays in Scotland, and it stays bleak. Isn't that right, Anahi?
It is.
Tell us about Morven Callan.
I will. I don't have that much to say. I watched this a while ago. I did think it was really beautiful, but I think the main reason that I watched it was that people had talked about it a lot as a precursor to After Sun. I think Charlotte Wells herself has talked about that After Sun wouldn't exist without Morven Callan. And I, obviously, as number one president of the After Sun fan club, was like, okay, I want to know what this is about. This film is insanely dark. Like, it's more dark than After Sun. Like, a lot more dark. In ways that I wasn't expecting at all. It's about this young woman, and at the very beginning, I think it's like Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, she comes home and she discovers her boyfriend has killed himself, and he's left behind, like, the manuscript to his novel and a mixtape. Like, I don't want to make a comment about gender, but like, what a list of things to leave behind. And like, he did leave a suicide note maybe, or something really brief. Or this really like bizarre kind of collection of things. And instead of doing what you should do if this happens to you, you should call the police, which I don't normally advocate for. But she dismembers his body and buries him in the mountain. And then she like goes to Spain and then tries to sell his novel, which is also a comment on gender.
Anna, do you just hate to see a girl whilst winning?
I do. I think that's the problem. So it's like very, I see the parallels with After Sun in that it's a very kind of like very visceral depiction of grief, right? Like, it's not holding back in any way. And the scenes where she's in Spain and this kind of sense of rootlessness and drifting, and she's with her friend and they're not quite matching. Yeah, I can definitely see where like the influence comes from, but it's a lot darker and just a bit more, not empty in like as in the quality of the film or like what the film means, but empty, I think, as a kind of political statement, where After Sun is so full of feeling and there is a kind of catharsis that comes out of it. Whereas this, I found it hard to really, not exactly empathize with the characters, but it is just, it's just like really horrible. Like, what they're going through is really horrible, and they don't really seem to feel like there's any recourse to anything. And you're just kind of watching people like spiral downwards. I don't know. It was a very strange experience, but it is like really, really beautifully made. I haven't seen any of her other stuff because I really struggle with this kind of genre of cinema. I refuse to watch We Need to Talk About Kevin, which I think we're going to talk about in a bit. I will never watch that in my lifetime. And then You Were Never Really Here just seems kind of gross. So I also haven't seen that. So I haven't seen like quite a few of her stuff. And I don't know if this really makes me want to, but there is a really beautiful way with which she films this that I did like, was like, it was nice. Like, there's like the flashing Christmas lights. Is that like part of it? And you can like see the lights like flashing on her face. And that's really cool. But yeah, a strange one. I think I went into it being like, I'm going to love this. And I didn't. And I wasn't really sure what to do with that.
Well, what did we say earlier? Sometimes it's just not a good match.
Yeah, sometimes it's not a good match. Yeah. Yeah. I think it was just like, oh, yeah, I think if something is going to be that sad, and this is the impression I get from her films, I need something to kind of, like a moment of catharsis, which is probably very like basic bitch of me, but I think I do need that. Whereas with her stuff, it just feels very like, oh, you guys are fucked up. There's nothing else to do.
Speaking of guys who are fucked up, we need to talk about Kevin, Jimmy.
Yeah, I mean, this is probably our most well-known film, probably. It's like she went to America to make it. Probably most complex in terms of its structure. It's kind of told in this kind of intertwined flashback from the point of view of Eva, who's played by Tilda Swinton. She's a mother who's looking back on her fraught relationship with Kevin, who's a son, who's played by several actors, including quite memorably Ezra Miller in one of his early roles. And yes, Eva's a mother who can't form a bond with her son. You know, she's like, she doesn't quite know why. And because this film's from her point of view, you're never exactly sure if it's her problem or the son's problem. It seems from her point of view, her son is a little dick. Her son is always misbehaving, and he's kind of gaslighting her and her family because he's an angel with his dad. But then as soon as his mum's taking care of him, he's like, you know, he's just refusing to play along. He's lying. He's doing all these kind of naughty things. And at first it just seems like a naughty kid, but it becomes more and more troubling as he gets older and he starts to do darker and darker things. And it's an idea of a parent who is rejecting their child, but also seeing so much of themselves in their child. So there's like the film is like full of these kind of amazing match cuts between Ezra Miller and Tilda Swinton, who kind of look very similar, like these kind of high cheekbones. Mm. It's clearly her son, but she's kind of disgusted by what she's created. And it's a kind of really kind of it's just an interesting look at motherhood and how that, you know, some mothers might not want their children or feel ambiguous towards their children. And the question is, is that what causes this kid to go off the rails? The fact that his mother does not love it? Or is the reason the mother doesn't love it is because the kid is just evil? So it's got that kind of question at the heart of it, which is quite an interesting one. But yeah, it's a film that's, again, it's quite a vibey film. It's just a film full of like great imagery. It's like there's a lot, you know, like I say, it flashes back and forwards. Eve in the kind of present day is just kind of like hated by everyone. Everybody blames her. You know, she's the mother whose kid has went, I wouldn't say what the kid does, but he goes always on to do something horrific, and everyone in the town blames her. She, you know, she's a pariah, and it just kind of, it follows on how she got to that position. So it's very much from her point of view. You never actually know what's going on in the kid's head because it's all from the mother's point of view. But it's just a really chilling look at, I don't know, like how a psychopath could be born and what might. And ask some questions: what causes? Is a really improvement on the book. The book is quite interesting as well. But the book's like a letter. It's like the mother's writing kind of letters to a friend, I think, talking about her son. And it's more chronological, I think. So this kind of, by breaking it up, makes it much more interesting, I think, and makes it much more ambiguous about what's going on. But yeah, great film. Like really chilling. Her use of colour is fantastic. It looks kind of quite different from her Scottish films, which do have that kind of like a very kind of rugged kind of, like they're shot in film and they're kind of like very kind of grainy and washed out. This is much more saturated, much more kind of pretty looking film, but very dark, very, very troubling.
I think just reading this film synopsis like back in the day put me off having children. Sorry, like, I'm not doing this. Like,
the power
absolutely
of cinema,
not. Yeah, truly.
So those have all been kind of like interesting bits of often quite realist filmmaking. I mean, we need to talk about Kevin has more kind of like cuts about in the plot a bit. Marvin Keller has this kind of like, well, you wouldn't do that, would you? Kind of vibe to it. The most recent feature that she's made is just I would say, the closest thing she's done to a genre film. You Were Never Really Here, starring Joaquin Phoenix. And when I say genre, it is possibly the most American genre that there is, which is man hunts down baddies to save girl in distress. I can't think, we were discussing this before we came on mic, and we thought maybe Cop was the only genre of film that is more American than this. It's that kind of revenge fantasy. It's that thing of like, oh, if this happened, I'd kick everyone's ass. And then I'd jump out the window and go, yeah! And then Metallica would play and I'd jump in the car and it would start first time and we'd just drive away. But Lynn Ramsey, with that kind of concept, makes the most real version of that kind of film, which is just bleak and unsettling, but has this kind of unstoppable like momentum to it. And it shows you that the kind of person who would actually do this sort of work of hunting down like trafficked children isn't Denzel Washington with like a sharp haircut and cool quips in like kind of Tony Scott lighting with like the camera flying around every 2 seconds. It's moldy looking Joaquin Phoenix with an enormous beard, very complex trauma and some obvious undiagnosed mental health problems. Just like battering fuck out of people with a hammer. Like that is what this film is. And it kind of has at the center of it is this idea that like violence can't really be contained once it's got loose. Once you've cracked the can, it's all coming out. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it is like, and I think it's very interesting reading for a bit of levity at the end. Very interesting reading one-star Google reviews for this kind of film, because it had like a proper cinema release and people like saw trailers that were like, I recognize that guy and I recognize this kind of film. And what they actually got was a film that made them say, quote, they never explain the flashbacks or the main character's past. It's just a man crying and depressed. None of it makes sense and the ending is terrible. Save your time and watch something else. Wish I could give it a negative rating. All of you giving a good review should go watch Die Hard. Now, that's a good movie. Which is a banger. Other classics. I would say spoilers in the following review. By the time this movie was over, I was ready to hit myself in the head with hammer. Phoenix, as always, is a great actor, but he should have passed on this script. Full of questions that are never answered, elements that are never explained, leaving the viewer to wonder when it will all come together. The extended lull in scenes with no speaking, the droning noises and irritating unexplained flashbacks will leave you wishing you were never really here watching this terrible movie. And it's a great example of like what happens when you get these kind of, because we've talked a little bit about this in this episode, it's kind of a nice place to finish actually, the expectations that you have when you go to watch a film and how they can impact on your enjoyment of the film. And sometimes you think, I'd like to watch a film that has a bit of pace to it, and you don't get that. Sometimes you think, I'd like to watch a film that has like a neat resolution, and you don't get that. Sometimes, you know, you and the film just don't quite match up. These people who I'm reading out just now are idiots. I'm sorry.
Sometimes you want to see Die Hard and you get a bleak movie about a man who suffocates himself.
You cannot go online and write, the movie is literally at the halfway point before you get anything other than artsy memories and flashbacks. I get that we need background, but again, it was half the movie before anything at all actually happened. No one needs that kind of time for character building when the message is that the character is simply disturbed.
Did my mother write this review?
Think about that. It's like, and it's also, it's just like, it's incredible as well, because it's like, oh, it just took half the movie to adequately explain the character at the center of the film. What did you want to do with the rest of the time? Think of all the song and dance numbers we could have had. Then you get a little action, but it's still constantly being pounded with how angsty this guy is. It was exhausting and boring throughout the whole film. Then there was one that me and Ellie did saw but didn't take note of, where someone was like, thank God you did the Joker after this to make up for it.
No way.
To recover.
Maximum his respect for the people of online.
If it weren't for Joker, people would be calling him Joaquin Phoenix. Yeah. Nobody would know who this guy is.
Joaquin Phoenix, more like no keen on this film.
Phoenix.
So Ratcatcher is out on the top. Jim, have you got anything else to add on the...
I was just going to say, I was going to say she has supposedly two films in the works that are going to come out soon. So after, she's going to like, you know, add 50% to her portfolio after a couple of years. So she's working on a film which is going to be a... It says here it's a revenge film set on a luxury Arctic cruise starring Julianne Moore and Sandra Oh. Sounds banging. And then she's got a film called Die My Love starring Jennifer Lawson, which is based on a novel by Argentinian writer Ariara Harwich. Anyway, it's about somebody living in rural France.
Produced by Martin Scorsese.
Yeah.
Wow, who loses her mind in marriage and motherhood.
So
the Holy Trinity.
Truly. She's not.
She goes to pick him, doesn't she?
She's not moving to rom coms. Let's put it that way.
If you walked in a bookshop and you saw Lynn Ramsey come in, you'd know exactly where to set
her. Yeah.
Hello, shopkeep. Hope all's well. Just looking for your most depressing and gnarliest books, please. I've got a bit of time off. So Ratcatcher is getting a 4K, as I said, 4K restoration re-release on the 12th of April. There are screenings lined up at the GFT, the Cameo, the DCA, and other independent cinemas across Scotland. The Glasgow Film Theatre are also doing a Lynn Ramsey season, in which you'll be able to laugh along with the rest of us at all of the other films in the Lynn Ramsey back catalogue. So that'll be a hoot for everyone. I bet you they're all like programmed at really... at times like Sunday afternoons and stuff like that. It's like, well, what do you want to do this weekend? Oh, something cheery. All right, let's go and watch Morven Cowell. But it's 20 degrees outside. I was going to go to the park. Nah. Now let's go and see Joaquin Phoenix batter a bunch of nonsense in the head with a hammer. And I think that's probably all we've got time for on this episode of The Skinny Skinny. So it just remains for me to say thank you, Ellie.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jamie.
Cheers, Pierre.
Cheers, Anahi.
Thank you.
And I've been Peter. This has been The Skinny Skinny Podcast. We'll be back in 2 weeks. If you've liked this, then follow us on socials and tell your friends about the podcast where they talked about the extremely slow-paced Japanese film and then that one where all those people got hit with hammers.
Instead of Die Hard.
Instead of Die Hard.